Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, I'm going to be talking summer food with Chef Erica Drum. We'll be finding out what's in season, how to cook it, and I'm going to be asking her, how are we supposed to stay interested and enthusiastic about cooking dinner every night? I'll also be joined by the yoga sisters, Emer and Niamh Daly, to hear about the latest in health and wellness news, including the UK are to open their first alcohol-free hotel. And I'll be joined by Connor Moolah. He has launched a fertility supplement for men based on his very personal experience of a fertility journey. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm back after a bit of an adventure. I was away with my family for a lovely long break. I was in Chicago for a weekend, just us four, and then on to my sister and her family in Michigan. Long-term listeners of the show will know what a roller coaster I have been on since my sister moved to America, I think 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I have been there before, but I'd never brought my husband and kids to see where they live. And it was my first time to actually be there in the summer. And we had the best time living lake life. And to have that time with my sister and her family, it was absolute bliss. I am going to write an extended piece on my Substack, and I'm not just saying that to sell it, but I feel like I've lots I want to say, because obviously the conversation about America has changed over the last few years for obvious reasons. And when you are getting information about America by news alone, it can cloud your judgment, and rightly so in very many ways. But to go there and be in a bubble and just meet lovely American people was actually very positive. And there was lots of positives that I had, but I suppose it was very personal to me. I was on a holiday, not a political rally. It was a bubble of joy, of friendly people, as I say, of days on the lake and family time. It was much needed and I loved it. I say much needed because before I left, I was absolutely exhausted. I talk a lot here in the show and at any corporate talks I give about the 12 steps to burnout. They were devised in 1992 by two psychologists, and they are Herbert Freudberger and Gail North. And they wanted to dig deeper than just you do too much and you end up not being able to do anything at all. And I always talk about the first three steps because I think it's really good advice for people, myself included. The first three are the need to prove oneself, constantly seeking outside validation, valuing work above all else. And then the third one is neglecting your own self-care. And I always talk about trying to catch it there. But that's all well and good. But when the work keeps coming and the responsibilities, and depending on what chapter you're on in your life, sometimes it's nearly impossible to stop and slow down, depending on what you have going on at any one time. Because the steps after that are mainly symptomatic. They're things like withdrawal, changing of your values, denial, behavior changes, until you start to get to a feeling of almost detachment. And I think these can really creep up on you before you even realize it, because we talk a lot about how busy and overwhelming life is, how tricky it is to keep all the balls in the air. So sometimes we'd be forgiven for thinking this is just how life is. To feel overwhelmed all the time is normal. I knew I needed a break. It came at the best midpoint of the year. I put out of office on everything. I dipped in and out a little on social media and emails here and there. But I didn't feel any pressure. And I was in a different time zone. I feel so lucky to have had that opportunity of the last few weeks. And I just share it to be conscious of where you're at in the steps to burnout and what you might be able to do to just stop and slow down a little bit more. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, the Yoga Sisters are back. Emer and Niamh Daly of Daily Wellbeing join me in studio now with the latest in health and wellness news. You're very welcome, ladies. How are you both?
Hello.
We're good. We are delighted to be back.
Enjoying the summer. I have seen you've been doing some beach yoga.
Yes, our beach yoga is back up and running for all of August. We're delighted. We love to just be back together on the beach doing yoga.
So that's Portmarnock Beach in Dublin?
Portmarnock Beach in Dublin, yes. And then we go for a little sea swim after, and then we head to Honey Honey for a little coffee.
Okay, I need to join. What day is this on?
Every Sunday in August at 8:30 in the morning.
Okay. Okay, you may or may not see me there, but it does sound delicious, but I will be on air. I'll have to just scoot out later on. Now, story first, Walking 5,000 steps for 3 days can increase your life expectancy. Tell us more, Niamh.
Yes. So for so long, we have been told that 10,000 steps a day is a target that we need to do. But a new study from the London School of Economics tells us that just 5,000 steps 3 days a week is actually all that we need, which is a lot more achievable as well, I think, for people who are working full time as well or might have kids. We don't need to be stressing about getting those 10,000 steps. 5,000 steps 3 days a week. And it actually can expand your life expectancy for men for about 2.5 years and then women almost 3 years. And then just with that, it's going to impact you a lot positively through not just your physical health, but mental health as well. Getting out in fresh air for just 5 minutes in the day is going to completely de-stress you, just heighten your mood. Being outside can change everything. So those 5,000 steps are very doable, very achievable. So I think just swapping maybe the car or the bus a short distance, if we can walk to the train or walk to work and get those 5,000 steps in, it has a massive impact.
The bone health coach, Annette Cashel, was on the show a couple of weeks back, and like, she really stayed with me. She was talking about being an active couch potato and how so many of us go to our classes, our gym classes, or, you know, maybe do a walk or whatever, and then sit the rest of the time. And she was talking about looking for opportunities to move. So like you're saying, parking a bit further away. If you're working from home, getting up to take a phone call while you're working. You do see it a lot online, don't you? People in the States on their walking pads doing all their meetings. Mm-hmm. But just, we don't have to go crazy about this. I don't like people, as you say, feeling under pressure to hit 10,000 steps or they're not living life. Mm-hmm. But just finding little ways to add a few steps. I know, as well as being yoga sisters, you're also dog-minding sisters. You borrow a lot of dogs and they are very good for getting the steps in, aren't they?
They are extremely good for getting the steps in. Depending on what dog it is, you could be getting well over those 5,000. But yeah, we also mind dogs quite regularly, so they get us out and about. And if you do have a dog, if you don't have a dog, maybe go walk a dog for someone on your road.
Yeah.
Get those steps in.
Get your connection in. Another important piece in the wellness puzzle. Eimear, you have a great story about the UK are to open their first sober hotel.
Yes, I absolutely love this story. So the Long Lane is a countryside members club which is opening in the west of Sussex. It's about an hour outside of London and it's going to be opening in late 2026. So this is a space created purely for wellness and just kind of giving yourself a moment to just really be zen. So the creators of this are Louise Blake and Harrison Hyde, and they said they want to create a space for people who are healthy Monday to Friday and want to keep that going throughout the weekend and stay in that wellness space. So the biggest driver here is that it's completely alcohol free, and that's what's really honing people in. But you won't be missing out on anything when it comes to luxury here. They have an alcohol free bar, a herb distillery, and personalized nutrition for your own needs. So you'll be met with someone when you come in the door to say, tell me everything about you and your body and what you like to eat, and completely focused on wellness dining. They also have amazing things when you get into the bedrooms. They'll be able to pick a mattress. You'll be able to kind of say, what lighting do I want to wake up to? So you're completely immersed in this wellness experience. And then you'll have all of your other lovely things like yoga and Pilates. But another really nice piece is that it's surrounded by 55 acres of woodland, gardens. You can go for your runs. I just think this is such a nice piece in what society is now classing as luxury, and kind of giving yourself that moment of, I'm actually going to look after myself this weekend, but I'm still going to have like a really nice experience.
I mean, alcohol can still be part of a healthy lifestyle. And sometimes I often say it is wellness to go for cocktails with the girls, to go on a weekend with your partner, you know, and having a drink is okay. But I do think it's really interesting that this is where things are going, that there is such an appetite for alcohol free. After coming back from 3 weeks away where there was plenty of drinking, I feel I'm going to take a break. And I feel that's part of the conversation a lot more. So I said to my husband, my next trip is with my mother-in-law for her 70th in September. And I said, I'm not going to have a drink until then. And even if I'm feeling it, I might not when I'm away. And I think that's part of the sober, curious conversation we're having, that going away for a weekend doesn't have to have alcohol in it anymore.
No, I think we've brought a story here before from Bank of America did a piece on Gen Z and where they're spending their money. And we saw that they're spending it in wellness spaces. And a lot of that Gen Z don't want to spend it on alcohol as well. So I think we are shifting towards it. But I love your perspective on like going for cocktails as well is wellness. It's all just about where you are in your life and your wellness journey.
Yeah, love it. Niamh, there's a survey that shows we're pretty much addicted to the internet.
Yes, there is. Pure Telecom's Connected Life survey found that 29% of adults in Ireland say they couldn't last a full hour without the internet. And that's nearly one in three of us. And then it gets more extreme than that. One in 10 people, so over 400,000 adults, say they can't even go 15 minutes without the internet. But what's really shocking is that 40% of people will turn down 5 million euro just so that they can have the internet forever.
That's these sets of questions my teenage son asks me. He asks me these things all the time. Would you take a trillion euro, but you have to kill everyone in your life? Like all of these kind of questions. I mean, do you think people are doom scrolling or do they need it? Because often, like say on a holiday, for example, I'm like, I'm going to leave my phone in the hotel room and I'm just going to be present. And then I need it to pay for things. I need to find where I'm going. Exactly. My tickets are on it.
Our life is very much dependent on it. In saying that, though, it's not all just doom and gloom. Like, as you say, people can be doom scrolling, but people also use the internet to connect with friends and family living abroad. For example, if you're on your holidays, you might want to FaceTime someone. We're going to use the internet then. So it does have a really positive impact as well. We just need to know the kind of balance that we want to have with it. But over 70% of people, they actually believe that the internet should be part of our public utility bills, same as electricity, same as water, which I guess is a fair point when you bring it into account that you're using it to communicate with people, because that leads on to the mental health side of things as well, which the internet does help us with. If you're living abroad from all of your family, you want to FaceTime them, a WhatsApp call from them, this is where the internet is a great positive impact.
Yeah, it just doesn't need to prioritise over everything else. It's worth looking at to make sure it's still in balance. And perhaps this could be an antidote to that then, Emer. We could put down our phones and go to the movies or a museum.
Yeah, I love this story. So the Institute of Science in Tokyo took a look at adults in their 50s in the UK, and they found that adults who took part in cultural activities like going to the cinema or a museum or a concert or a sports outing had the physiological age of around 3 years younger than those who didn't participate, which is massive. And for anyone who doesn't really know what the physiological age is, it's like how well our heart is pumping, how well our BMI is going, just how well our body is functioning as well. So it's really interesting to see this, but the researchers really want people to know that by going to the museum, you're not instantly going to be, you know, setting yourself back a few years. It's the components that build this up. So they built it, they put it down to three things. So one of the things is kind of combating loneliness by going to these events. You're surrounded by people, you're probably going with a friend or you might be going on your own, but you don't feel that kind of sense of loneliness. And that's something you talk about time and time on the show, Claire, is that sense of belonging and connection. So it's really nice to see that here. They also put it down to having better mental health. So by going and getting yourself outdoors, whether it's a concert or just experiencing life, your mental health is going to really, really benefit from that and just release some stress as well. And then the third one is just being curious and kind of having your mind constantly learning, which is going to museums, you're probably going to come away learning something that you didn't know before. So it's really, really nice to know this. And I think if you're looking to book a ticket or go somewhere, this is a nice kind of thing to say, do you know what, it's actually going to impact my health and my longevity. So let's go for it.
Yeah. And there's so many free options. So it's well worth going on the internet for a moment, Niamh, to Google what's in your local area. We will allow that.
Yeah.
If people want to find out where the Yoga Sisters are, their upcoming events, Emer and Niamh can be found at Daily Wellbeing on Instagram. That's D-A-L-Y, their surname. Emer and Niamh Daly, thank you so much for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Erica Drum is back with us in studio. You'll know her from the 6 o'clock show. She's up and down the country at all the festivals talking about food. and she's Erica Drum IE on Instagram, where you'll find lots of fab recipes and details of her upcoming book, Dinner, which is available to pre-order now. And Erica joins me in studio. You're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Claire. Delighted to be here.
Fresh from All Together Now. Did you see the Go Loud tent?
I did. It was brilliant. I passed a few different things happening. Actually, I must get on that next year. Were you there yourself? No.
No, I had a family weekend. We only got back from the States. And then there's a family holiday we always do with three other families to Inishbofin.
Okay.
So I thought long and hard about it.
No.
But yeah, to arrive back from America, to dump the kids, to go, it just didn't seem right. But I had absolute FOMO 10 times older over, and I will be there next year for sure.
Yeah.
You had a great time.
It was amazing. I have to say, Kermore House, the whole setup is just so beautiful. The rain stayed off quite a bit. Like, there was a little bit of drizzle that we probably needed for refreshment at some stages, but that was it. And like, that really makes or breaks a weekend, I think. If it's peeing rain, you're kind of, it's like a bit annoying, let's just say. But it was fantastic. I spent a lot of time down the Theatre Food, the Kitchen Press stage that's run by Ali Dunworth. A lot of fun going on. We've kind of steered away from the demos and just making meals and recipes to more like the chats, the conversations, the tasters, the food, you know, different chefs that you might see normally just cooking, and there they are talking about their memories as children or, you know, stuff like that. Really good fun. And then I got to see a few bands, of course, and Billy Scurry, a good friend of ours that we both know. Just really good fun. Loved it.
That gave me the serious FOMO, the Billy Scurry DJ photos. But I wanted to talk to you about Dinner, because that's something on my big holiday and break, I said, right, what do I want to do with this new energy, this reset when I come back? What are some of the things I want to implement? And to have my enthusiasm for food return, I had got very lazy, very bored of cooking. At about 5 o'clock, I'd be like, oh God, what am I going to cook for dinner? Grab a chicken breast, grab some potatoes, grab some veg. Fine, but I wanted to bring back some excitement. How do you manage that? Because I know everybody is like, what do we have to cook for dinner tonight? It's one of life's tricky, tricky decisions.
It really is. And my book is called Dinner, but I'm the exact same as you. I really am. Like, we all are. It's a hard thing to think of. And that's what I talk about in the book, is my mother in the 90s, like four kids under her feet, you know, asking what's for dinner before they'd even finish their breakfast. Like, just that constant creative energy you have to put in every single day. I think one of the best methods is to do a rotation of a dish. Like, it's, you know how handy it is to do a recipe that you know everyone in the house eats, or like if you're doing a veggie version and meat version or whatever, just that kind of thing. So finding those recipes that the kids love, remembering, asking them, because obviously you want to cook for you, but there's nothing worse than having to cook, you know, four different dinners in the same night, or, oh, I don't like that, you know. So trying to figuring out ways of, like, you know, altering. It's, go back to the traditionals, the spag bol, the lasagna if you have to, you know, that's, there's no harm in it. Like, they're still delicious meals. But I think, yeah, elevating the chicken breast a little bit is nice. Mom used to do this gorgeous Parmesan one when we were kids, actually. She'd put the chicken breast in milk for a few hours, and then she'd bake it with a bit of mustard, not so much that it was potent strong, but mustard and Parmesan cheese. And that was it. Like, it was really simple, but there's a bit of cream as well, so that created a sauce. We had that with mashed potatoes and some sort of veg. You know, it is the same as just grabbing the chicken breast, but it's just a little bit more elevated. But yeah, there's loads of recipes in my book. I actually have a whole section on pasta and noodles, because that is my reach to when I'm like just starving, have to make the dinner for everybody, can't even think. I go to noodles. I make some sort of a broth, whatever protein I have, or even if it's eggs or something, will be boiled and then put on there, a veggie sliced up or chopped. There's always things like noodles and pasta, I think, in our presses. So that's a good one to think of.
Yeah. And I do think, including the kids, if you're making family dinners, that takes it to a whole new level. Because look, my kids are older now and they're like, oh, boring, this again, no, I don't like that. And that's a killer. But I was just with my sister who has kids under eight, three of them, and they were saying the same with most meals she put on the table. Like, that is just,
oh, it's so
comes
hard
with the territory. But I think the more you include them, like, yeah, when my kids were little, if they got to stir the pot, if they got to chop a few veg, if they got to be involved in cooking it, they were more likely to eat it. And now if I say, what would you like from the supermarket shop? What do you fancy this week? You pick a dinner, you pick a dinner. Often, like tonight, we're having spice bag chicken burgers.
Oh, fun.
Made in the air fryer. So like that's their kind of food, yeah. But I'm making it without phoning a takeaway.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot for the brain,
that's
isn't it?
That's great inspiration. But I think you're right, including the kids and what they're going to make. Also learned a good tip, like Stella, my daughter's only four, so I'm not at the older stage where they're really telling me what to do. But it's serving things family style as often as you can is really helpful because the kid then has the autonomy to say they want more or less. And, you know, it's different than when we were younger. You know, we don't tell our kids about starving children in Africa and stuff. That doesn't work. Let them be intuitive towards the food as well. And getting them involved changes everything, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Putting it all in the middle of the table and just encouraging them to eat and eating the same. So let's talk then about what's in season, because that's why I really love to have you in, because, you know, people often wonder in a health and wellness show, why are we talking about food? But that's the very basis.
Oh, yeah.
I think a healthy relationship with food and body is paramount and enjoying our food. So what is in season at the moment and what should we be cooking with?
I absolutely agree. And I just want to preface, I'm not a nutritionist or dietitian. I'm a recipe developer, chef, and a huge and delicious food enthusiast. But my biggest thing to say is to eat the rainbow. And that's what we can do at the moment. We are abundant in Ireland with the most delicious produce, July, August, September. Even into October, we've got tomatoes, aubergines, the courgettes, cucumbers, those things that require a lot of sun and a lot of water have been growing all spring, you know, late spring into summer now, and they're really at their prime. So something like aubergines, one of my favourites, and Claire and I used to work together a long, long time ago, and that's where I learned how to make this dish called Parmigiana, and it's in my book. It's one of my favourite meals. Actually, the back cover of the book is me scraping the plate. There's an Italian word for it, scarpetta, I think, where you mop up the juices with bread. And that's layers of grilled or pan-fried aubergine with mozzarella and tomato sauce baked in the oven, like a lasagna, I suppose, but no pasta sheets. It's one of my favourite meals. I think it's my death row dinner, to be honest.
It's yum. Aubergine can divide people, can't it? Because
absolutely.
It can be difficult to cook. There's some keys to it, isn't it? Like adding salt to the slices if you put them in the oven or pan fry them is important, isn't it, to take that moisture out?
Yeah, it does take the moisture out, but really the main thing is to make sure you fully cook it. So that's probably where people have gotten it's gotten a bad rep is because that it's been soft and
spongy. Gross.
Actually nearly chewy, which is not what it should be. And then other people think it absorbs too much oil, which it does. It's a sucker-upper, like it really does absorb whatever you give it. So spray oil if you can, or brush oil on it, or sometimes I might place oil on a plate and then place them in it instead of drizzling the oil. Because if you are pouring oil, each piece is just going to suck the bit that it gets. It's not going to share it with its other pieces. So I think that's important. Pan frying it. Like if you're not sure if you love aubergine, get a piece, slice it up, drizzle or spray the oil or whatever, drizzle into the pan, whatever you want to do. Pan fry it until it's fully soft, like all the way through. Salt on it and taste it. It is absolutely delicious, like just on its own. And that will give you a real taster to see if you do like it or not. If you don't, fine. But if you do, there are so many gorgeous recipes. Like caponata is a delicious kind of Italian style ratatouille, which is aubergine, courgette, olives. It's fabulous as just a side with your chicken. Like that could be your dinner, you know, and you've done a plain chicken breast or roast chicken in the summertime, and then that's your kind of summery side.
Yeah, and you can batch cook that. You can do a lot of that and then throw some in the freezer. That is a good one. You have fennel on the list, and I love fennel, and I never really know what to do with it. If I see it in the supermarket or my local shop around now, yeah, I might sometimes drizzle it with a flavoured oil, throw it in the air fryer, and it is lovely, but I'd like to do more. When I was in Inishbofin at the weekend, they were serving a slaw of it with dressed crab. Would you need a mandolin or something for that? Because I always think when I take the rough pieces off, I'm not really left with much, and there's the stalky bit at the top. I find it a difficult shape to manage. It's not a cucumber, shall we say.
It's definitely not. I suppose think of it work ways like an onion, in terms of you could have it raw and in a salad, and it's nicer when it's sliced thinly for that situation. No, I don't think you definitely need a mandolin. They're handy, but I met someone the other day who'd taken the top of their finger off. And like, yeah, they're dangerous. And if you don't use the safety thing, you have to be, you know, really cautious with them. And I think I'd rather people just either use a knife or Have thick slices, it's fine. But yeah, so a salad, what happens is they're quite hard. So they need that acidic dressing, or say in a slaw, they probably have a mayo or something that's going to break them down and get them a little bit softer. I love them just pan, like in a pot, like you would make sautéed onions. So treat it that way and just reduce, let them soften in a little bit of oil and butter. Of course, it's always gorgeous. I know I've mentioned roast chicken already, but they're absolutely gorgeous as a base. So get two or three, half them, quarter them, drizzle with a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, place your chicken on top. So you know, as your chicken's roasting, all those juices are coming out and going in. Fennel has a really, it's also kind of a divider as well. I don't think everybody loves it, but it has a really unique flavour. You know, that kind of licorice-y, but not too strong.
Mm.
And then the texture has that crunch. It is unusual. All the top bit you can eat, all those stalks you can eat, by the way, all the herby parts you can eat if you want as well, the bushy bit at the top, that's quite like dill, same family. So yeah, I wouldn't be afraid of it. It's definitely a harder vegetable to chop because of its hardness, but cut it down the middle so you've still got the centerpiece on and use that as your bit to hold on to. And then even though, you know the way sometimes it goes into three or four kind of roundy stalky bits at the top, they're perfect. Cut them as well. So they're gorgeous to eat.
Yeah, I want that under a roast chicken right now. And finally, the berries. All of the berries are in season now, which I think is amazing. And I love to see packets of berries that are actually from Ireland,
yeah,
because this is the time we're supposed to be eating them, really.
Absolutely. Like, we are probably coming a little bit away from Irish raspberries. Strawberries are still going because there's so many strawberry farmers here in Ireland. But we're coming into, like, well, we have gooseberries, which are usually wild. Not many are cultivated. And blackberries. Like, Stella and I go picking blackberries any time. Like, they're everywhere on the walk to school. They're down the country. They're in the cities. But absolutely gorgeous. And yet, you talked about freezing earlier or batch cooking. These are something you could do, like, if you really love Irish berries like I do as well and don't want to be using, you know, foreign berries in the middle of winter, buy some now, give them a little wash and throw them in the freezer, or make yourself up a nice coulis or jam or something, and preserve what is in season right now for in the future, because that's what we used to do. You know, we used to not waste this moment of, you know, abundance, and can things, pickle things, you know, jam things, jelly things. So I would say, as much as you can, buy those berries, get them into us while we can, and then savour some for the future by doing something, freezing, pickling, making jams.
Well, you'll find her at ericadrumie on Instagram, and her upcoming book, Dinner, it's out in October, but is available to pre-order now, and all our dinners will be sorted. Yeah. Erica Drum, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Claire. See you soon.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Odin Health is an Irish male fertility supplement brand founded by Conor Moolla. His reason for starting it is about as personal as it gets. Conor was told he'd have next to no chance of having children of his own. Rather than accept that, he built something. Odin is now one of very few Irish brands speaking directly to the male side of trying to conceive, and Conor joins me in studio now. Conor, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We made it happen. You and I met at the Future Fertility Show, and I just thought your story was so powerful because, as I said before the ad break, we don't really hear as often from the men in this discussion.
Yeah, and I guess that's probably a bit why I do it myself. And yeah, I'm not usually... I was always told I had a face for radio, so it's weird to be on radio and then talk about male fertility. It's not how I thought my life would go, but yeah, here I am.
Here we are. So before we get into your personal story, when would you have started to consider your fertility? As a teenager, would you be thinking about the possibility of getting someone pregnant or the quality of your sperm or anything like that?
Yeah, to be honest, probably never really thought about it, other than obviously I went to school in Ireland, and the only thing you thought about basically is you should be afraid of getting someone pregnant. And never you should think about if you can get someone pregnant. So you, at least for me, and I know a lot of the guys that have talked about it, is you always assumed that what you need to think about is make sure you don't get someone pregnant, and not do I need to worry about even getting to that phase.
Yeah, I think that's something, you know, only in my anecdotal evidence as women, as young girls, we're taught that it can happen at the drop of a hat. And then, you know, you get into a situation later in life where you are looking to get pregnant and you realise it can be a bit more complex than that. And that's where you found yourself. So yourself and your now wife, Kerry, when did you begin to talk about having children?
Yeah, it was, I remember quite specifically, we'd gone away and Christmas time in January 2024, we decided that we were adult enough now to consider having a family. And that's when we started trying. And like that, you go into a lot of excitement. And the first few months are exciting. And then it turned into, okay, strange, still nothing happening. And then it was actually a year before we then took kind of formal action to get ourselves tested. So honestly, I hadn't thought about my side of things at all. Kerry, during that first year, was making loads of changes. She was taking supplements. She was drinking less, exercising more, always researching what she could do differently. And I kind of just turned up, so to speak. So when I got my results back, and it was on Valentine's Day 2025, I got my results back. I wasn't really expecting anything other than a formal, yeah, you're good to go. So when he told me, yeah, he gave me these results in lots of medical terms. And I said, look, what does that mean? He said, look, you probably won't be able to have kids. And I remember as soon as he said it, it clicked in my brain. I couldn't look him in the eyes anymore. I actually had to look down. And to this day, I still remember he was wearing white Crocs. So I have like post-traumatic Croc syndrome. Like I just can't see Crocs anywhere without thinking of it. And all of a sudden I had this huge wave of shame and guilt. And I was like, didn't really know how to work with it. And kind of as I was leaving, I was like, look, what can I do? And he said, oh, maybe look into a supplement. That was the only advice I got. And yeah, I remember walking home, and I'll be honest, I cried. I still remember being on the phone to my wife, and just so many things going through your head. What's it mean to be a man if you can't reproduce? How could I be a good husband that I was letting my wife down? Yeah, so it was quite a lot at the start.
And it came down to sperm quality. That's what was said in that meeting.
Yeah, so without getting into the nitty-gritty details of it, there's kind of a couple of sperm parameters that they look at. So one is motility, so how well it swims. The other is the concentration, so how much of it is there. And the other one is morphology, so it's shape, so the shape of the head and the shape of the tail. And I had issues with both the motility and the morphology. And yeah, that was my issue, so to speak.
And it is personal, isn't it? As you said, because it's got so many ramifications in your personal life. But I just think it's really commendable of you to say it made you question, well, who am I as a man? Because I know women go through this a lot, and there's a lot around the language used in fertility when people are told they have an inhospitable womb space and other such things. And you take it that your body is letting you down and there's that you are personally responsible for this. We don't often hear this.
Yeah, no, and particularly for men as well, I think we have a more sensitive ego, so to speak. And I think a lot of, look, for me personally, I linked it to my masculinity. And then as I was going into the research then, yeah, it was all about masculinity and people linking fertility to virility. So yeah, at the time, and the first few months were pretty rough, I felt super alone that I couldn't talk to anyone about it because like that I was less of a man, less of a husband. So it was tough. And then I decided, and at the time my thinking was, well, it was misplaced, I think, male pride, where I was like, I'm going to try fix myself. Not that there was anything broken and I wouldn't use that now, but at the time I was thinking, I'm going to fix myself. What can I do? And I'd gone then into a lot of research papers, and I think in the fertility world in general, there's not enough research and focus on it. And when it's more on the female side of things, so my pool of research was relatively small, and I kind of found these nutrients that had been studied that had then proven to improve sperm parameters. Then I went to look for a product on the market that had these kind of 10 ingredients at the doses that they were studied at, and I couldn't find that anywhere, which frustrated me. And I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I was like, well, if I'm going to try to fix myself, I'm going to do it properly. So then I kind of sourced it all individually, and I remember at one point, I actually had a picture of it, there's like 15 tablets on the table. That I was taking every day. I felt like such an old man, but I did it. And then after 5 months, I got retested and my numbers had all improved past what would be considered from infertile into fertile. And then a month later, we got pregnant with what is now our daughter, Hope, who's named because at one point we felt like there was no hope. So it was very apt for us.
I could actually start crying, Connor. I know when we met, you told me your wife was pregnant, but it was lovely to see on social media that your daughter had arrived, and I didn't know until the ad break here now that her name is Hope.
Yeah.
And I know this conversation will give a lot of people hope. And this is one of the frustrating things often about many situations within the health environment, that, you know, what happens in research doesn't quite make it down to the consumer. I mean, if you hadn't sought all of that out, which must have been difficult to do, and you hadn't gathered together all of those 15 pills, you might not be where you are today. So people need to be able to get access to the information.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the mission behind what I do. What I do is, I could have just accepted that diagnosis. You probably won't be able to have kids, and we would have probably gone in the IVF route and probably invested quite a lot of money and emotion and time into that. And not to say that that's a bad thing. I think IVF is great and such a good resource that we have. But had I not proactively kind of advocated to myself, the journey might have looked a lot different for us. And that's kind of why I talk about sperm on social media. It's really not where I thought my life would go. But I think it's important that, again, I think men were relatively lucky. Again, we have this window where sperm regenerate every 74 days, so let's say 3 months, that if we make small, consistent changes within that window, it can improve our sperm quality. So you don't even need to have a bad diagnosis. If you know you're going to have, or you're planning to have a family, just take 3 months to make the small changes, whether it's exercising more, eating better, drinking less alcohol. And I say it to people, and people come up to me at the Future Fertility Show, I'm like, the worst case scenario is you're just healthier for 3 months. That's the worst thing that can happen. And you don't even need to spend any money. You could probably save money.
And you had made these changes along with the 15 pills.
Yes.
You had made some lifestyle changes.
Yeah, so I would have liked to think at the time I was relatively healthy already, which probably why I came as more of a shock. So I ate well, exercised quite a lot. The changes I made were around two things. One was alcohol, which was the most difficult for me personally. And the second one was around heat. So heat has a huge impact on sperm quality. So having your phone in your front pocket. I know now saunas are the absolute biggest thing in Dublin, but also to be conscious of that as well, like cycling as well, stuff like that. So those were the two areas where I kind of focused the most. So it was a bit random. I travel quite a lot for work. So when I would come home, I was conscious that I'd be sitting for a long time. And I would always then sit on an ice pack while we're watching Netflix or whatever. And at the start, my wife was like, this is totally bizarre, Connor, what are you doing? But then it just became part of the habit for those, what turned out to be 5 months, 6 months before we got pregnant.
Wow. You know, it's so interesting that you have that 3 months, because otherwise I think that would get quite cold.
Yes.
And difficult. But it's nice to have that 12 weeks, and obviously beyond, you went into 5 months, six months. But to have that in your mind, to make these changes over 12 weeks for the new cycle of sperm quality, I think that would be really helpful to any men in a similar position. Can I ask you as well about sharing it? You obviously at the start it was a big shock to the system, and you and your wife had to navigate it, I'm sure, together, and you had to get your head around it. But when did you begin to tell people, either your close family or your close friends?
Yeah, that was definitely the most difficult. So close family would have been at the start, like parents really, talking about it, because they knew we'd been trying, and I don't know, if I felt like I was better to get ahead of it, so to speak. And then I only felt I could open up to friends when I actually got that first test result where everything was then normal again, because then I didn't feel as embarrassed looking back on it now. That's why I felt I could open up. And it was crazy. So I had three really close friends, and I spoke to all three of them about it. And two of them had already known people who were going through IVF because there was a male factor issue involved. And the third guy, he said it was one of his biggest fears that he might have an issue. And then I asked him, well, have you gotten tested? He's like, no, geez, I would never get tested. Which, again, I think is part of our ego.
Yeah, and again, you're able to say, well, look, you can turn things around potentially within 12 weeks. And I think that's really positive information.
Yeah.
And I really hope that's something people get from this conversation. Let's open up a little bit more, because I'd imagine your wife was discussing with her friends in the lead up while she was making those changes. And she was asking questions and saying, well, because often this happens, everyone's doing it at the same time, aren't they? Everyone's getting engaged, having their hens and stags, getting married, if that's the way your life goes. And then potentially, you know, your two best friends get pregnant and someone else, and you go, geez, well, we give it a go.
Yeah.
It's that kind of way that life tends to happen. So there are other people in your circle going through the very same thing, and yet we keep it quiet. And I understand it's a very personal journey, particularly if there's issues. Yeah. And every time you meet people, you don't like to be told, you know, questioned any news, what's happening, to discuss
inner details as you are in the radio now about your sperm quality, but I think it's important because it can be so helpful. And as you said, when you did it, it turned out there were, you know, three people going through similar to you, and you were able to give them valuable information.
Yeah. And kind of what I tell people is, I mean, it's probably not at the level yet where it's going to be pub conversation about your sperm quality. But I know a lot of my circle, they're now mad for like high rocks and marathon training and stuff. And they talk about what they're doing to prepare for it, how they're eating, how they're training. And I think that's the same approach we need to take to treat having or preparing to have a family in the same kind of way. It's, you wouldn't just run a marathon tomorrow. So maybe we should, when we do something as important as start a family, also look into how do we prepare better for it. And for me, and what I always try to tell people, it's just small, consistent changes. You don't need to upend your life, but maybe instead of the 3 pints that you would have on a Friday, you have 3 non-alcoholic, or maybe just 2 pints. It's about small changes that I think can have a big influence. It doesn't need to be a full turn everything upside down.
Yeah, like I'm sure Hope has now that she has arrived, and we will get to that. But let's talk about your other baby, Odin, the supplement brand. I was Googling you to prepare for the interview, and you had a really good job. You have upended your life to bring about, I assume, turning 15 pills into a smaller number.
Yeah, I actually do it. I still work full time. So I have 2 full-time jobs now with the baby. Actually, like, feels like 7 full-time jobs. But yeah, when we had the success, I kind of thought, geez, it's crazy that like there wasn't anything available. And honestly, I did it a bit on a whim to set it up. I just had this feeling I wanted to do something. So then, I decided I'd want to manufacture the supplement. So it's manufactured here in Ireland. We've kind of been live since the Future Fertility Show there in March. And yeah, really, for something that I never really had planned in my future, it's now growing quite significantly, which is really nice. And every day you get messages on Instagram, people saying, oh, even little things like, thanks for sharing the videos, because it allows me to talk to my husband about his fertility in a much more open way, to people saying, no, your supplement has been great. So that's Odin. I'm actually terrible at talking about it. I'm not a very good businessman in that sense.
But look, you're just sharing your story and you're starting the conversation. And if people want to find out more, what is the Instagram?
So it's Connor, Conor, and then like an underscore Odin, O-D-Y-N.
And why is it called that?
Well, when I was going through it, the biggest thing that I always felt was like I was less of a man. And all the supplements on the market were either targeted towards women. So they had started a female-focused brand, and then they kind of put on this male fertility supplement as a tag on. That makes, at least at the time, I felt like less of a man. Or they were marketed to be quite medical, which I also think is important to say. A supplement isn't a cure. It's not a magic pill. It works in conjunction best with lifestyle changes. And it's in the name. It's to supplement what you don't already get from your diet. And the last one was, if they weren't medically targeted, they were things like suggesting that it would improve your masculinity. Whereas I think we need to separate fertility from masculinity altogether. So then I just wanted something that didn't feel anything like that. So Odin kind of just came about. Now, that, because we have really, I guess, research-backed doses, I could say that ODYN stands for only doses you need, but that's only in hindsight that I can stand for that. And when it came to the design, what I thought as well, I wanted something that a guy could have on their kitchen cup counter. And if a friend came around last minute to visit, they wouldn't feel like this need, oh geez, I need to hide that away. That it was something that could sit there and not be so embarrassing, or that there was something wrong with you, but rather it's a proactive thing that you're doing.
I love that. Okay. Tell me about Life with Hope then. What age is she?
She is now 5 weeks. 5 weeks and 2 days. As my wife texts me every day, oh my God, she's another day older. I'm like, yep, great. We got there. So life is totally different now. We did all these classes, and you think you're prepared for it, and then she came and everything totally upended. But I have to say, I love coming home every day and just seeing her. And then the screaming starts and then it's less. But yeah.
Yeah, it's constant. And 5 weeks is really the trenches. I don't even think you come up for air until about 12 weeks and possibly never truly breathe again. But it is a really special time. And, you know, I think it's important to say not every fertility journey ends with this being the particular happy ending. And I love now, through conversation, through podcasts, we're being a bit more open now that you can still have a very fulfilling life mm-hmm. if you don't become a parent, although that can be very difficult to get your head around. However, that is not yourself and Kerry's story. And I think it's a really brilliant one, a really powerful one. And let's open up, let's talk about it a little bit more. Conor Moolah of Odin Health, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
On.
Thanks.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. Rory Galvin was on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.